に上がりゃ関係ねえ。
Shall we begin?
Winter is coming.
I can do this all day.
Tear down this wall.
行くぞ。
Join us on this captivating episode as we delve into the fascinating world of history with our special guest, Louis Sarkozy, as we explore the enduring legacy of Napoleon Bonaparte, unraveling the layers of his impact on France and the world. Louis brings a perspective of a not-so-ordinary Frenchman to the table, offering insights that intertwine the personal and historical narratives. Louis, thank you for coming, and are you ready to go genuine, uncensored, and unscripted with us today?
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a great pleasure.
Yeah. Well, Louis, you are our national brother-in-law, apparently. You are a son of the former president of France. And how the boy, that boy, became someone who is obviously a lot of Frenchmen tends to research Napoleon or admire him. How did you become this historian that wrote a book about Napoleon? Well, also, you were a designer at one time, if I'm correct.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not exactly a designer. I have no fashion sense whatsoever. But I had a friend who had a very great fashion sense. And we had an idea to create a shoe brand together. And instead of honoring, you know, as clothing brands do today, great athletes or musical artists, we wanted to honor intellectuals. So we did shoes that revolve around great intellectual figures. My partner had all the fashion sense, and I more brought in the idea of using intellectuals. And so we had fun, you know, trying to sell this project. But to answer your question, it's sort of an irony that the French kid gets into Napoleon by reading an English book. And that's very much what happened to me. I read Andrew Roberts' biography of Napoleon, Napoleon the Great. I think it came out in 2015 or 2014. And it was just a revelation to me. I mean, I had learned, as all French kids, you know, when you're younger, about Napoleon, about the reforms, the great man, the campaigns, but nothing really stuck. And I turned, you know, into my late teens, early adulthood, looking for heroes, as young men usually do at that age, and found that book. And it was, I mean, a revelation. I mean, Roberts does such a great job at portraying not only the military genius, but the political genius, the man of the Enlightenment, the lover of culture, the great polymath. I just had no idea before. So that started just an infinite devilish spiral, Napoleonic spiral, a huge rabbit hole that I'm still not out of. In fact, that's why I'm sort of writing a book about the guy, so I can stop thinking about him. I want to get him out of my life. It's been too much now.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is the wrong step to get him outside of your head to be in this podcast.
Indeed.
Got fascinated by Englishmen writing Napoleon, but do today kids may have a chance to be fascinated by Napoleon by watching Ridley Scott's version of Napoleon in the movie? What's your opinion?
Well, it's much tougher. It's one of the great worries about the movie is that now you have a generation of kids who are going to see that movie and think, oh, that was him. And as you may know, I've been very critical of the movie. I think the movie is atrocious. I think it's bad, not only because it's historically inaccurate, I just think it's a bad movie. I mean, I'm not the guy to say, oh, you know, it has to be absolutely accurate. Everything has to be perfect. No, it's a movie. Ridley Scott was perfectly right when he said, don't get your history from movies. You know, you want to learn about the man, you get a book, you get a documentary, you know, you do something else. And he's right. But I just thought it's a bad movie. And plus, as you may know, in France and in Europe in general now, we have a very difficult view of Napoleon. And it's very funny because as you go through the decades, popular opinion about Napoleon changes, and it really reflects more about us than it does about him. So now the big issues of the day, of course, are, you know, racism, sexism, colonialism, discrimination. And of course, when you look at him through those angles, he comes up short. Of course he does. You know, this is a man who was born in the 1760s. I mean, of course he doesn't have our values. Of course he doesn't have our morality when it comes to issues which were, in many respects, completely accepted in his time. So when you have the prevailing opinions being very critical of him because of slavery, of colonialism, and of sexism. And by the way, we can talk about those things because he wasn't a sexist, he wasn't a racist at all. But I mean, people say that he was because people are not very well educated on the subject. And also, you have movies like Ridley Scott that come out, which portray him as sort of this dumb, cruel brute who got there by luck. You have a generation of kids who don't see him who don't know who he is, who think he's not a figure worthy of further study. And that's a great crime, because as I've said, and many others have said, I mean, he's the most, probably one of the most fascinating humans who've ever lived. He was such a weird guy. I mean, my God. I mean, it was probably so bizarre. Probably had no friends. He loved his first wife, Josephine. Probably didn't really love any other. Obsessed with work, obsessed with politics, obsessed with war, immersing himself in every detail of every campaign where every regiment is sleeping, you know, getting the proper logistics. Just a complete workaholic and a maniac. But also a great man of culture. And as I try to portray in my book, you know, reading voraciously, but also discussing music. I mean, this is a guy who would go to a dinner and would go to a mathematician and talk about this equation and that equation. He would go to a chemist and talk about the result of mixing these two experiments and these two compounds. And I mean, he would go to, he impressed Goethe. Goethe was one of the greatest living philosophers of the time, probably the greatest living German writer in history. And he talked with him for 2 days in 1807 at Erfurt. And Goethe was completely impressed. Was like, my God, this guy's a theatrical critic. He's a literary critic. So he's just this incredibly weird and brilliant figure. And everybody should know that. And everybody should learn about him, not only about his great attributes, but also his great faults. I mean, the guy had so many faults. He so many mistakes he made, so many shortcomings, so much ego at some points, so little clairvoyance, so little vision. And, you know, he's a paradox. I mean, just like all the great individuals in history, the mistakes are just as great as the accomplishments. So I just think everybody would benefit from learning more about him.
I mean, one does not expect when he goes to Ridley Scott's movies to see documentaries, to see the historical classics. It's obvious to expect the historical fantasy in some way. But when you go to see Ridley Scott's movie, like you said, it's not just historically inaccurate, it's a bad movie. You do not expect to go and see Wikipedia pages come to life, basically. And to not connect with the person like Napoleon and similar. And like you said, Napoleon is polarizing figure today for many things, but with that comes many misconceptions about Napoleon, like you mentioned some. And but isn't one of the biggest legacies that Napoleon left was meritocracy, right? Because he today is mostly accused that he abused power, that he abandoned French Revolution. But actually, during his reign, meritocracy was one of the main systems of quality in France, right?
100%. You're completely correct. He created the first meritocratic decoration award in French history, the Legion of Honor. So all awards before that were aristocratic. You know, it was very, very rare, if not impossible, for a commoner to be awarded sort of royal decoration. He creates the Legion of Honor, which is awarded purely on merit. It doesn't matter who you are, who your parents are, where you're born. You can get it if you prove yourself worthy. Some of his marshals, I mean, come from nothing. I mean, one of his marshals' father was an innkeeper. The other one was the royal mole catcher. I mean, these were normal. Normal people with no title of nobility, no title of aristocracy, and he found them. He saw they had talent, either military or political, and he was smart enough to say, I need these people to be with me. Now, that mostly changed after, let's say, you know, 1807, 1808. He becomes the much more established, you know, fat monarch who sort of sobs, is less energetic, is less willing to find talented disciples and much rather looks for yes men, like any dictator would a little bit. But this is really the second half of the reign. The first half of the reign, it's really all the best that the revolution can offer. The meritocracy, the meritocracy, the get rid of the aristocracy, etc., and none of the bad. I mean, he ends all the bad. He ends the appel au meurtre. He ends the grave instability. He ends the incessant coup d'états. And he says, you know, we must finish with the novel of the revolution. Now it's time to write its history. So the first half of the reign is really this amazing meritocratic moment. And he was known, of course, for singling out brave soldiers during battles. Or brave units, when a unit had performed very well, you know, he called them up and he had inscribed, you know, like sort of very motivational epithets on their flags, you know, the brave and the disciplined, etc. Mm-hmm. But also when a unit did not perform well, he punished them. And that was something that the soldiers, you know, in all eras of history look forward to. They want to be rewarded for their accomplishments. And, you know, they want to know that people who mess up in the army are also punished. So that absolutely still plays that to his military leadership as well.
But the key on that note also, what you mentioned, he praised where there was something to be praised and punished where there was something to be punished. I have a feeling, for example, in the film, and not just in the film, I think this is maybe oversimplifications. When we present somebody as evil, we can only see him in one package and everything that comes with that package. You know, for a guy like him, and if you consider him evil or anything, like when somebody gets into that kind of position of power, he didn't do it because people disliked him or because he wasn't charming in some way or because he didn't have something that connected to the people. Do you think, because in film, I think that isn't done very well because he comes off as not somebody I would follow,
yeah,
especially not in the war. Do you think that Napoleon, even if he was like a little bit of socially awkward in that, do you think he had that little bit of charm for the people? God.
He the man captivated an entire generation. They were all obsessed with him, hating or loving him, by the way. So his great critics, when they met him, said, okay, there is something to this guy. He had the most amazing charisma and energy. I mean, when he walked into a room, everybody shut up. I mean, when he approached somebody, you could feel the energy. He was bombarding you with questions. And like he meets Goethe in 1807. He's like, Goethe, do you have a wife? Do you have children? Are you well preserved? How old are you? Do you feel good? What are you writing right now? And it just an incessant torrent of questions. Of course, he had wonderful eyes, which always help. Many of the contemporaries tell us that the portraits didn't capture the eyes. We don't have a single portrait that really captures these wonderful blue-gray eyes that he had. And yes, I mean, you watch the movie and you're like, why are these soldiers following him? Why is Josephine so in love with him? Why does Talleyrand want him to become king? I mean, this man captivated an entire generation, even his enemies. Listen, there were so many English admirers of his. Lord and Lady Holland, they were the chief of the opposition. That's a very powerful political figures. Loved him. They were complete Bonapartists. They sent him books on St. Helena because they knew that's what he loved most of all. There's even a wonderful song that was written by English sailors, right? So these are not friends of his, right? Like say English sailors died and suffered and fought against his wars for 20 years, right? These are his arch enemies. And they wrote a sea shanty called Bonnie Was a Warrior, which is very moving and very homage-driven. It's an homage to him, like the worthy enemy. And I encourage everybody to listen to it. I think Eric Clapton has a wonderful version. It's available on Spotify or on YouTube, that Bonnie Was a Warrior. And I mean, if this is what his arch enemies think about him, what does that say about him, right? Like this is a man who is incredibly special. And he inspired the most violent hatreds, but also the most devoted love. Somebody like Chateaubriand, brilliant French author, and was a great enemy of his, was not a fan of his at all. But after he left power, Chateaubriand writes, what are we going to talk about now? What are we going to write? I mean, in him, there was every quality, every fault. It was the energy. It was like a shooting star. And now we are condemned to boredom. I mean, there's nothing else to talk about now that he's gone. I mean, in those 20 years, there's everything. There's the great victories, the conquest, the reforms, the meritocracy. Everything changes. It's the splendor, the glory, but also the death, the carnage, the horrible defeats that we can talk about. Russia and Spain, these huge catastrophes. You know, France loses so much territory, etc. And when he's gone, it's like, wow. What happened? I mean, this man was a tornado that came through, shone so brightly, but it was so fast and then disappeared. So you're absolutely right. He had amazing charisma, amazing energy, electrifying attraction about him. He has such an orbit, such a gravitational pull. Listen, even at the end of his life, 16 people follow him to the last exile when they have nothing to gain. I mean, he inspired fascination. Right. People met him and they were fascinated. Even if they didn't like him, they were fascinated. And when you watch Joaquin Phoenix, you're like, who is this guy? What? This guy, he arrived by accident? He's like, I don't know if you remember, but there's a scene in the movie when he's eating dinner and they're arguing with Josephine. And there's and he says in the movie, Josephine's like, "You've grown fat." And he says, "I enjoy my meals. Destiny has brought me this lamb chop." Destiny has brought me this lamb chop. This $180 million. Joaquin Phoenix, Ridley Scott, the 3 years waiting for the biopic, and we get Destiny has brought me this lamb chop. Is this a joke? What are these sex scenes? I mean, there's like six of them. It's a num 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 num. What is that? What is that? What does that mean? It's so nonsensical. I mean, it's so bizarre. And of course, Phoenix captured nothing of the man. He was a Mediterranean. He wearing his emotions on his sleeve. Phoenix plays him like he's from northern France in the middle of winter. No emotion. He cries twice in her handkerchief. You don't see any of the charisma. So no, I was very disappointed, just like you.
You see, he was also, which is like more visual detail, and it's not exactly Phoenix's fault because somebody cast him. He was too old to play Napoleon because Napoleon is in his late 20s, you know, as we know him in his prime. Yeah. And Phoenix is near 50.
Yeah, so, but I'm not as angry about that because it's such a challenge. Listen, they cover 20 years in the movie.
Like, yes, that's fair.
That's the first mistake.
Exactly. And I couldn't agree more with you. I think the only way to do him justice is to do like a long form TV show. And people tell me, oh, but people aren't that interested. I disagree. I mean, I don't think audiences are that stupid. I think if you give audiences something that's more true to life, it doesn't have to be perfect, but more true to life, and you put an effort to pay attention to what the historians say, etc., it can yield great benefits. You can take liberties, as any director or actor should, but audiences have proven that they have the attention to spend, you know, 7-8 seasons on a show. This guy's life was more amazing than anything they show in Yellowstone, anything they show in Breaking Bad. I mean, his life was insane. I mean, it is the craziest scenario you could write. The battles, the drama, the tragic. Like, pay some respect to the audiences, make a long form TV show, pay some attention to the historians and see where it goes. I mean, I think it's a completely willing financial risk.
I don't know, because I read, you know, there was the story, and not the story, it's been confirmed that Stanley Kubrick at one point wanted to make Napoleon, and he done like crazy amount of research and almost got the film into production, but then Waterloo came out and that fucked it up and this and that. And if I remember correctly, that Steven Spielberg had parts of that script and he was talking with HBO about producing a series on Napoleon. Now, I don't know if that's like still a thing, but that would be amazing.
It would be amazing. And I love Steven Spielberg, obviously. But just like I loved Ridley Scott before that, he's an amazing director. But obviously, you're right. I think the TV show would be much better suited. And I actually think Phoenix looked good. I thought he looked like that first scene, the first scene in the movie, the execution of Marie Antoinette. Of course, he wasn't there, but okay, we don't care. So they execute Marie Antoinette, and then they show Napoleon. His hat is sort of off to the side, and he's looking like, you know, very skeptical. And I thought that was a very good shot because that was his attitude. So on one hand, he's a revolutionary. Very clearly, he's a revolutionary. But on the other, he always was wary and afraid of the crowd. And it's very interesting paradox. The revolutionary who's not too revolutionary, the pragmatist, the opportunist. And I thought that first shot was fantastic. I really thought it looked like him. But of course, as soon as Phoenix opens his mouth, it loses everything.
Yeah, and I think also they wanted with that scene to tell, you know, that famous line of French Revolution gave birth to Napoleon.
Yeah, and that's a fact. I mean, it's undeniable. You know, it's like, I forget exactly who said this, but I'll probably find it in 20 minutes. But it's like, in great moments or great men and women in history is when the situation meets the man. So sometimes you have a great situation and you don't have an individual, and sometimes you have a great individual, you don't have the situation, and so we don't know who these people are and we don't know how these great events could have unfolded. But with Napoleon, you have the massive volcano, which is the French Revolution, and you have this incredible man, and they meet at the perfect time, and the result is the greatest story in human history, and one of the most lasting ones. So I meeting of the situation and the man, in his case, in my opinion, would make for the best TV show in history. But I'm a little biased on the subject.
What would be number one misconception that gets Frenchmen, that gets you pissed off about Napoleon?
That he was a warmonger. And that he initiated all these wars and killed all these people. There were seven wars of the coalition, seven Napoleonic wars. Out of the seven, he declared two. The rest were defensive wars, right? And no blame is put on the Austrian emperor. No blame is put on the Prussian king. No blame is put on the British. My God, the British, who funded every war.
No, we blame them. No, trust me, we blame them.
You and me both, but most people funded every war. I mean, encouraging probably for his assassination at some point. I mean, just absolutely warmongering. He only declared two. Now, of course, you would be perfectly right to say these two were catastrophic, which were Spain and Russia, and they cost him his empire. Like, listen, he paid. He paid for this too. There are the two reasons why he lost everything. It's these two wars. All the rest were declared on him and on revolutionary France. So the monarchies in Europe were terrified of the revolution, and for good reason. I mean, they were established legitimists. They did not want any peoples in Europe putting back into the question the legacy or the legitimacy, rather, of the crown. And so when you have this revolution and you install this republic or later the directory, it's very confusing to them, and of course very terrifying. So we need to crush this right now because we don't want this spreading to our country. But then don't tell me that Napoleon was the one who wanted to expand and conquer all of this. Listen, it's undeniable that after a while, he was a very bad diplomat. And he won these great wars, but he didn't know how to win the peace. He constantly humiliated the other countries and the other monarchies. Instead of reassuring them, he humiliated them. Right? They could have been a lasting Napoleonic empire if he knew when to stop. But at the end, you know, he's like, we win. Okay, we'll take Oldenburg and we'll take Sicily and we'll take Spain. It's like, okay, but this was Talleyrand, his great diplomat, knew that this was catastrophic, and Talleyrand realized that this system would not last much earlier than everybody else, because Talleyrand knew that you simply cannot win in Europe a lasting peace by just constantly adding conquest. But still, we're very far from the image of the great conqueror, etc. So I would say that the warmonger is number one misconception that pisses me off, and number two is probably the racist. The racist is so egregious. Mm-hmm. Such a lie. I mean, and it's so easily broken, this lie. Like, as soon as you read his correspondence, as soon as you read about the Egyptian expedition, you realize the guy was not a racist. He was a pragmatist. I mean, he said himself, he's like, if I was Jewish, I would rebuild the temple. He didn't care. Like, if you were good, like, he wanted you near him. And if you were bad, he wanted you away. He couldn't care if you were gay. I mean, Cambaceres was a homosexual. And he was the number two of the regime. And of course, Dumas' father was a general, which of course messed up after a while, but for a long time was rather close to Napoleon. He gets to Egypt. He issues translated versions of the Quran to French soldiers. He says, respect local traditions, respect the imams as we respected the priest in Europe. So absolutely not a racist. I mean, complete nonsense. But people today don't want to learn. They want to sensationalize. They want the one opinion that's going to get everybody riled up. They want to provoke, and then they leave the room. And then historians have to come in and sort of try to dust off everything and try to fix the reputation. But of course, I mean, a 75-year-old historian who teaches at Harvard is never going to win against a guy with, you know, purple hair in the street yelling. It's like, he's always going to get more attention. And nobody's going to sit for the 4.5-hour lecture at Columbia University about the intricacies of racial relations in early 19th century France. Unfortunately, you know, historians are doomed to lose that battle.
Yeah. Well, Napoleon is one of the greatest military genius of all time. But when everybody speaks about his battles, the first one that come to mind are the Russia and the Waterloo. And yeah, we do not speak about Egypt, about conquest in Italy and similar things. But speaking about conquest in Russia, the blame for his loss is most usually the harsh Russian winter, but it was also a numerous other factors, like strategic mistakes, and similar stuff. So what's your take about conquest in Russia?
So the Russian
invasion...
Because
we don't see it in movie, of course, except for a few minutes.
Yeah, we have 6 minutes. I mean, this is the greatest military disaster in human history. Yeah. I mean, by far. I mean, nothing compares. He enters Russia in 1812 with about 500,000 men. It's the largest army the world has ever seen. Mm-hmm. He leaves, there's like 45,000. I mean, out of every 12 soldier that enters, so if 12 soldier enters Russia in 1812, two come back to France, two out of 12. Everybody else is dead or captured. I mean, it is, the catastrophe is huge. I mean, and so why? What happened? Well, I mean, there's been whole books written just on one aspect of this, but and I should probably say I'm not by far an expert on the Russian invasion, but I think it's very clear what happened. One, there's clear ego. So he's been winning for 10 years, and he thinks he's unbeatable. And his huge army, he's never had an army this size. He thinks there's no way I can lose. Two, there's no clear war aims. So he goes to war without a goal. He says, oh, yeah, we want to make Russia stop the continental system. But Russia was an ally a year before. I mean, he goes to war so fast. I mean, there's complete neglect of diplomacy. Huge mistake. And three, the Russians played this brilliantly. I mean, people say, oh, it's the winter. The winter played its part, but the Russians won the war. And I feel like it's a great insult to the Russian army to say that it's the winter that won it. No, the Russians played this brilliantly by not fighting in the beginning, retreating, let him come in, always, because he wanted one big battle, win, crush the army, and then leave. So they don't fight. They let him come in. And then the great resilience of the Russian people that they've shown so many times in their history by burning everything, scorched earth policy, burning all the farms, burning all the forge, and at the end, burning Moscow. Like, can you imagine? Burning Moscow. I mean, they burn their one of the second or the greatest city in their empire. 90% of the population leaves when he enters. They let loose all the prisoners, and they tell the prisoners to burn everything. And Napoleon is shocked. He doesn't understand. He's terrified by the Russian strength to never accept defeat. And he sends an offer to the Tsar, Alexander, in St. Petersburg, saying, I've taken Moscow, now come, let's make peace, the war's over. He never answers. And Napoleon leaves precious weeks to go, 1 week, 2 weeks. He's in October in Moscow, and the weather's good. So he's like, there's no winter. No, we're good. Look, it's barely snowing. October's fine. It's nice, warm weather. And then the weather drops so fast and so violently in early November. And he gets scared. And he's like, okay, now we have to leave. We spent too long here. And then begins the most catastrophic moment in French history, greatest military disaster ever. And it's the ultimate cherry on the cake. I mean, it's nothing could have gone worse. I mean, if you had to remake the scenario, everything went bad. All discipline disappeared. The Cossacks came back in strength. Russians were receiving reinforcements. They ran out of food. They ran out of clothing. I mean, and it just everything just is just terrible. So I think the Russians played this wonderfully. His mistake was ignoring diplomacy, going to war with no war aims, and just being a bad ally. I mean, you don't declare war on your ally a year after. I mean, this is just a bad tactician. He never should have gone to Moscow. Obviously, he should have stopped in Smolensk. He had his winter quarters there ready. He had all his resources and supplies there ready. If he stopped in Smolensk, we probably have a different history. But he doesn't. He still thinks, you know, I can get them to fight. One big battle and it's all over. And as we know, we do have the big battle in Borodino. The French call it Borodino. The Russians call it the Moskova. Or rather, the Russians call it Borodino. The French call it the Moskova. Excuse me. And they fight this great battle. And that's when he takes Moscow. But of course, it's not decisive. And the Russian army is not destroyed. And then he lives with the consequences. And we lose basically the entire French army never recovers. And even 2 years later, he would still have trouble getting horses because so many horses died in Russia. All of the NCOs, the core of an army, the non-commissioned officers, there was always going to be a trouble of getting new ones. And of course, he has to institute so many conscription laws after that to try to re-get other men to fight that he gets incredibly unpopular in France. So, you know, it's a perfect disaster. Everything goes wrong. And of course, as you know, in the movie, we see nothing. We see four horses running around in a field. And then he enters the Kremlin, and the bird shits on the throne, and then he walks out. It's like, what is it? Did I? You give me 180 million, I make a movie just about Russia. That's it. It's like 4 hours, and it's epic, and I make no CGI. I just hire 20,000 people, and we just go
and burn Moscow,
and burn the whole thing, and burn the whole thing.
Yeah, but they also it gave right after that scene, the movie immediately takes us to him relinquishing the crown,
yeah,
which he gives off, as you now mentioned, he returned. He, you know, obviously did work. He did a return to Paris immediately, and the next day he was like, yeah, you're relinquishing the crown. And that's the kind of a vibe that the movie gave,
yeah,
which, you know, wasn't the thing. But also, I think one of the misconceptions that people have, and they say, and it's just a general knowledge about Russia campaign, people think that he actually went there in December. Like, when they say Russian winter, it's like, Napoleon get his horses and walked into Moscow in December, you know, yeah, started his campaign, which isn't true. You know, he thought perhaps that maybe much before the obviously Russian winter, we will get this done with.
Exactly. Yeah, I think he enters Russia. He crosses the Niemen, I think, in June. I'm not sure. I think it's in June.
Yeah, of course, I thought it was July, but you're maybe right.
Maybe July. Of course, he had read also, and he had with him Voltaire's biography of Charles the 12th, who had invaded Russia and who suffered disastrous defeat during the winter. So he was perfectly aware of the risk of going there in winter. But as you say, he thought he could get it done fast. And all his marshals, he calls a council of war, I think, after Smolensk, and they all say we should not go. And he you know, doesn't listen to them and still go. It's very tragic. And of course, as you say, after the after Moscow, we just see him abdicating, relinquishing the crown. We don't see the first of all, the frantic work he did when he got back to Paris trying to reorganize the army. I mean, it's almost like he's 27 again, sending off thousands of letters, reorganizing, getting supplies, trying to save whatever he can of his reign. We don't see the 1813 campaign for Germany, which goes until the Battle of Leipzig, the Battle of the Nations, the most international battle ever fought in European history with so many different countries. And we don't see his last brilliant campaign, which is the 1814 campaign for France, where his army is so small and he defeats in like a month and a half, three armies larger than him. But of course, as we know, it's not enough to save Paris, but it's his last great stroke of genius. And we don't see that in the movie.
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned that he read Voltaire on his campaign in Russia. So what I wanted to ask this question, he was somebody that, as far as I know, represented as someone who was a fan of the ideas of the Enlightenment. Now, yeah, some would say that it was obvious that he didn't practice them later, you know, since he was an autocrat and things like that. What's your stance on that? How do you see him and the Enlightenment and that those philosophies that flourished in those times? And do you know if did he ever had a chance to meet any of the Enlightenment philosophers, maybe?
He comes a little bit late to meet some of them. So Rousseau, Voltaire, of course, all died before he came of prominence.
I don't know their age, when exactly was, you know, they were dead and born.
So some of the great philosophers of the Enlightenment in France, at least, and people who would later be seen as having sort of created the intellectual movement that led to the revolution, they all die in like the middle of the 18th century, except one, which is the Abbé Raynal. Napoleon meets him. Napoleon wants to be a writer when he's young. He's completely obsessed with the philosophers of the Enlightenment, like Rousseau, like Voltaire, and he tries to pitch some of his book ideas to the Abbé Raynal. And of course, Abbé Raynal is sort of very tolerant with his young teenage admirer, and he tells him, oh, you should write a history of Corsica. So Napoleon starts to write a history of Corsica. It never comes to anything, but yes, so he did meet some of them. Your question is a very good one, and the answer is very paradoxical. On one hand, he is the incarnation of the Enlightenment. So he is the great reformer. He's the great unifier of the French civil code. He ends feudalism wherever he goes with his conquest. He abolishes the Jewish ghettos in the Papal States. He establishes meritocracy. He modernizes civil institutions. So he's the great man of reason and of the Enlightenment. And as you also point out, he, at the same time, as the years go by, institutes one of the most draconian censorships in French history, completely muzzling the intellectual publications of France. The same guy who reads all day, who loves authors, who loves literature, is the guy who creates the most insupportable censorship in history. I mean, it's so weird. So it's a great paradox. I think there's a change in him. When he's young, he's completely obsessed with the philosophers and the Enlightenment. And he wants to become a writer, and he enters some essay contest, and he writes this essay, which is just completely plagiarized from Rousseau. Okay. And then he starts in the military achieving some victories. And then he sort of forgets and moves on from the Enlightenment and the life of thinking and ideas, and he becomes a diehard pragmatist and a diehard opportunist, very concrete. And he's like, okay, clearly I'll never be a writer. Now the military is the option for me and I can achieve success through there. And then even his readings change. So he stops reading so much philosophy and he now focuses on history and on the military arts. So there is a very interesting change. I forget, one author talked about that. It's like there is a moment in his life when he decides no longer to think, but to act. All of his life, of course, is the great culmination of the act. I mean, all his life, he was obsessed with action instead of deliberation. You know, he famously, they said, oh, before him, the directorate wanted to make the great civil code also, but they never do it. People wanted to create the lycée, the primary school, but they never do it. And he does everything, right? Whether you agree with the decision or not is a different thing, but he acts, he does. He puts people in a room and he says, you don't leave until we have a solution or something we can implement. So his relationship to the Enlightenment is very paradoxical, but at the end of the day, I will say, of course, he was a man of the Enlightenment. Andrew Roberts, the English author I told you about in the beginning of this podcast, called him the Enlightenment on horseback, which I think is a great term. So he brought the Enlightenment to many countries through his conquest, but of course there's some caveats. People say, oh, but he couldn't have been from the Enlightenment. He reestablished slavery in 1802 or 1803, which is true. He reestablishes slavery, not in France, but in the colonies. A great mistake, obviously a great crime, but he does it for economic reasons and not for racial reasons, obviously. I mean, this is one of the many subtleties of his life, and people start screaming so fast, but it's very important to understand why he does it. He does it because with the peace with England, France gets back some of her overseas colonies, and he needs money for the country that's devastated by the revolution. And Saint-Domingue, one of the French colonies, is like something like a third or half of all sugar production worldwide. So it's this massive economic benefit. It doesn't excuse what he does at all, but one has to understand the context. And of course, later on, he abolishes slavery on the island of Malta. He abolishes slavery in 1815 when he comes back after the first abdication. So again, so many paradoxes, so many difficult gray areas, so many things to understand. But overall, I would say he was absolutely a man of the Enlightenment.
Yeah, I mean, during his exile in St. Helena, he allegedly had his enormous library of 2,000 books, right?
Yeah,
and 2,000 books at that time was pretty much like Congress library of U.S. today.
Yeah, and it wasn't enough for him. He would go through 2,000 in a couple months. I mean, this was not enough at all for him. But it's good you bring up St. Helena. There's this really amazing moment, which is probably one of my favorite moments of his life. He's walking on St. Helena, I think like 6 months after he arrived. So it's still the beginning of the exile. He would spend 5 or 6 years on St. Helena. So it's still the beginning. He's walking with Mrs. Balcombe, the wife of a very high dignitary, English dignitary on the island from the East India Company. So they're walking together and she is a British aristocrat. Right. Very much of the Enlightenment also, but very antiquated views when it comes to hierarchies, etc. And they cross some slaves who are carrying very heavy boxes. And Mrs. Balcombe walks ahead of the emperor and sort of tells the slaves to get out of the way. So they get out of here. You know, leave space for the emperor. Mm-hmm. And Napoleon stops and tells the woman, Madam, respect the burden. And this is sort of the idea that the emperor would say that about, would correct an English aristocrat on how she behaved towards slaves, really encapsulates his meritocratic ethos and his enlightenment ethos. I mean, this is respect to the burden. This is everything Napoleon. I mean, somebody is working, they're toiling. You respect the work. You respect the toil, even if he's a slave. Today, we consider that obvious. It was not at all in 1815, especially not to an English aristocratic woman. So this is a very touching moment that I find in his life, and I think it encapsulates perfectly what he is, which is that it doesn't matter if you're a slave or you're the son of the king, if you work or if you don't, that's what truly matters. If you're smart, if you're intelligent, if you're active, if you act, nothing else really matters for him.
Is it true that he was also, besides avid reader, that he also wrote letters like crazy? Because I somewhere read that he could pen like 10, 15 letters a day even.
Yeah, so we have 40,000 surviving letters today, which is, you know, a fraction of what he actually wrote. We have 40. So he wrote letters like Donald Trump tweets. I mean, it's just, it's obsessive. I mean, at some point he averages 19 a day, right? And I mean, he drove his coworkers mad because he's a micromanager. So I own here three of his letters. One of the letters I own is to his stepson, Eugène. And Eugène had just become the viceroy of Italy. And he writes him six letters that day. Right. So do this for the conscription law. Do this for the logistics. Do this for the Italian army. Do this for the next meeting. Do this for your coronet. It's just it's mad. I mean, he would spew them out, you know, dozens a day. So the absolutely amazing facet of his character and a great chance for the historian because it gives us so much material. You really get to see him in his correspondence. Of course, his great letters to Josephine are crazy. I mean, this is they're weird. They're insane. There's so much emotion, so much passion. I mean, at some point he tells her, you know, I'll be home in 3 days. Don't wash. like this is such a passionate, you know, Mediterranean, crazy in love young man who was, of course, later to be gravely disappointed. But, yeah, no, his letters are an absolute joy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and also speaking about him reading about history, about philosophy, being a guy who is influenced by Enlightenment, he also played the role in finding Rosetta Stone during his campaign in Egypt, which is crucial to understanding hieroglyphs later. So, but there are misconceptions that he personally found the Rosetta Stone, and actually it was one of his soldiers, right?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. So listen, he still deserves credit because he starts the Egyptian campaign and he says, I'm going to bring 200 or so of the greatest intellectuals alive. Listen, he's like 27 or 28. All right. And he says, I'm going to bring balloonists and engineers and sculptors and poets and writers and cartographers and antiquarians and historians and biologists and botanists. I mean, he brings along all these people. Probably because he wanted to imitate Alexander the Great, who, when he conquered Egypt, brought along 200 philosophers. And he knew that because he read Plutarch's Life, so he probably wanted to strike the same chord as Alexander. So he still deserves credit because many other generals, they would find a stone like that and be like, oh, great, you know, another to build a wall or something, useless, right? But no, he recognizes the intellectual importance of going to Egypt because Egypt is a completely, you know, dark country in terms of knowledge. Europe knew nothing about it. So he brings all these savants. He tells them, he gives them protection by his soldiers, something the soldiers hated to do. He sends them out on expedition to find temples, to, you know, capture animals, to record soil samples, to make bread in Egypt, to make beer in Egypt using local products. I mean, it's this great scientific venture. They create the Institute of Egypt, the great culmination of all the intellectual prowess that they brought together. They publish papers, they make a newspaper, and they pretty much invent modern Egyptology. And they pretty much invent modern archaeology. And of course, some of their findings will unlock the hieroglyphs. I mean, this is a huge venture. And it's not, it wouldn't have happened if he wasn't a man of the Enlightenment, to go back on our previous conversations. If it was somebody else who came, we have no guarantee, and probably we have a guarantee they would not have brought all these people with him. So an amazing facet of his character. Again, if it was Menou, for example, who was in charge of the expedition, he wouldn't have brought it. You didn't care. I mean, at the end, he says, like when Napoleon left the army and is back in France, and it's like 2 years later, and the army is like beaten now, and they're surrendering to the English. Menou says, so the English, of course, capture all the findings. They capture all the fossils and all the statues and all the animals and all the notes of the savant. And Menou is told that some of the savants want to follow their findings to England. They said, no, we'll never give them up. We're going to go to England. We're going to keep advocating to get them back. It's our work, etc. And Menou says, well, if they want to go, you know, have them stuffed like they're animals. So you can like, get them stuffed and send them in England. I don't care, right? Something Napoleon would never have. Like, he was completely aware of the importance of the scientific and cultural aspects of the expedition. So again, yeah, no, fascinating aspect of his character. If he was only known for Egypt, it would already, he would already be a very important person in French history and in European history. But Egypt is just one factor of his life. And of course, in the Ridley Scott movie, what, Egypt is what, like five and a half minutes? Something like that?
Yeah.
And then he bombs
the pyramids. It's just like it's so useless to say, why do you do this, right? Why bombing the pyramids, right? No, it doesn't improve the movie, and it's stupid. So maybe it's completely stupid.
The line that sent me over the edge is, I think he said in the movie that he, in the one of the letters to Josephine, that he wrote that he conquered Italy without bullet being fired or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is totally inaccurate.
Yeah, absolute nonsense and criminal when it comes to the history. Yeah, no, it just, I don't know what happened with this movie. I really don't. I mean, it's such a disappointment.
But what do you think, a quick one, what do you think about Sergei Bondarchuk's Waterloo from a Soviet movie? Did you watch it from the 70s?
Yeah, it's amazing. That's the one with...
It's a crazy movie.
Yeah, the Waterloo in 1971. Who plays Napoleon again? It's Bob Iger?
Is it Christopher Plummer that... no, Plummer plays...
Wellington.
Yeah.
Amazing movie.
Crazy movie. I mean...
Great.
He hired like Soviet army, 15,000 extras or something, real people. It was...
Rob Steiger is Napoleon.
Rob Steiger, that's right. Yeah, and that's amazing.
It's a over two-hour film just about Waterloo. So that should tell you something about cramming these events in 2.5 hours. I mean, what?
And he makes, with a 1970 technology and Soviet budget, a better movie than a 2023 technology American budget.
I
thought it was a great, great movie.
You mentioned previously that you have in your possession three letters from Napoleon, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And how does it feel to hold that piece of paper that he wrote on, and how hard was it to acquire them?
Well, it's amazing to have them. It's absolutely so. He didn't write them himself; he dictated them, but he did sign. So the signature is from his hand. And it's amazing. I can show them to you if you'd like. It makes everything real. It makes it, you read about this guy so often in the books, you see all the TV shows and the movies, and to touch a piece of paper that he did. I know I'm speaking to people who think like me here. To have to touch history like this, you know, I collect artifacts. I have Roman coins, Greek coins, etc. Some antique weapons. Of course, it's a tremendous, tremendous privilege. So should I show them to you?
Yeah, of course.
Let me get one or two. Yeah. So this is one of three letters I have. So this is a particularly amazing letter, and I'll send you pictures later on so that you guys can see in detail. So this is written when Napoleon is general in chief of the army of Italy. It's dated using the French Revolutionary calendar, and it's written to the Austrian general Colli, who is in charge of the forces of Sardinia Piedmont. And Napoleon have just beat him like three times in a week. And this letter basically says, if you want peace and you don't want your army to be destroyed, you're going to give me these three fortresses. So it's an absolutely awesome letter. And if I just turn it around, I'll show you his signature, because at this point in his life, he doesn't sign Napoleon. He signs Bonaparte.
Oh.
As you just see right there.
Yeah, we can see it a little bit. That's the other. Yeah.
Yeah, he signs Bonaparte, so he's not yet
Bonaparte.
Napoleon. He's still only just Bonaparte. So he signs at the very beginning of his life. He signs Buonaparte because he's still Corsican, and then it's Bonaparte, and then of course it becomes Napoleon. And then at the end of his life, when he doesn't care anymore, he just signs Napo. So I have a letter by him, and he signs it's like a treaty of commerce, and he signs Napo like across the page diagonally because he doesn't care. And he was such an asshole. It's like everybody signs in their little boxes, perfectly organized, and he signs in the middle of the paper because he's the emperor. He can do what he wants.
Progression of a character in his life.
Exactly. Yeah, we have, and you know, that's what, when you talk to Napoleonic historians, they all have a favorite Napoleon. So like somebody likes the young Napoleon when he's, you know, 30 years old, reforming everything. Other people like the old emperor who's obese and makes mistake after mistake, and because you're like watching a car crash. And people like, you know, after his death, people like studying the legend. You know, I like the reader. As you guys know, it's the subject of my book. That's what I really enjoy seeing him, you know, when he's, you know, alone or, you know, with his followers, you know, reciting books, talking about books. That's the part of him that really touches me. But yeah, there's so many Napoleons. He's so different when he's in his late 50s as he is when he's 27. As we all are.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But what about his final moments during his second exile? There's also conspiracy about his death, not being cancer, but being poisoned and similar stuff. But what was, in your opinion, state of mind for Napoleon in his final days?
And did he read at the time?
He read.
Yeah, so it's his, as one recent book mentions, it's his last passion, reading. So he reads voraciously, but for the first time since he's a young kid, he has trouble getting books. It's very difficult for him to get. So when he's emperor, he has these massive libraries with 60,000 books. And he orders books from everywhere, from Denmark, from England, from Spain. I mean, he wants everything. On St. Helena, he's a prisoner, and it's very difficult for him to get books. So it's a very tragic moment. His mindset at the end is he's depressed. It's sort of okay in the beginning, but then he moves into the Longwood House, which is a horrible place to live for multiple reasons we can talk about. And he becomes progressively very depressed. And then, of course, the cancer comes, which is going to, you know, kill him. I'm afraid he was not poisoned. The evidence.
Why would anybody poison him at that time? Basically?
Yeah. I mean, I hear the conspiracies that, you know, he was costing so much money. But no, I mean, he died from the same cancer that killed his dad, and that was to kill one of his sisters. So it very much ran in the family. We have the autopsy reports. No, it's very clear that he had cancer, for stomach cancer, for a long time. He was completely depressed at the end. He barely even read in the last weeks. You know, he couldn't finish a chapter. The man who used to read so fast, understand everything, get to the point of the book so quickly, now had trouble finishing a page. You know, one of the last things he reads is the Reveries of the Marshal of Saxe, which is the supposedly the war commentary that the Marshal gave on his deathbed. And he's inspired by this a couple of weeks before dying, and he gives his own Reveries. But the document is lost, so we don't have them, unfortunately. And he reads his correspondence, his own correspondence. So he rereads some of his letters and then dies. I mean, he's completely out of it at the end. It's not at all like in the movie when he's just in perfect uniform and just falls and this is nonsense. He dies in his bed. He was going in and out of consciousness. He was saying very, you know, nonsensical things. It's true that he said that the last words were France, Army, Josephine. But a couple of days before that, when he's in a reverie, sort of in and out of consciousness, he says something very interesting. He says, I leave to my son my property in Corsica. Andrew Roberts talks about this in his last chapter, because it's like at the end, that's what he was, like a small landowner from Corsica. And in his final moments, he goes back to that. And he just thinks, you know, he has this little farm in Corsica, or his little fields in Corsica as a little noble, and he leaves it to his son. So he came back to his origins in his last days, and then dies. And, you know, we know the rest, but he was very, very depressed at the end, and always wanted to, you know, all his life, he wanted to control everything. control information, control the military aspects, control politics. And at the very last days, you know, he is with Bertrand, who's by his bed, and he's obsessing over understanding who comes in and who goes out of the island. So he says, you know, where is this guy? And, you know, sire, he just left. Okay, where is this guy? Sire, he just arrived. And did they have shipments of fruits? Yes, the shipments just arrived. And when's the next ship coming? So always trying to understand, always trying to. It was the end of a great mind, you know. So it's very touching at the end to not only read about his death, but the years before to read him about trying to get more books, etc. So of course had a huge impact on him. He also wrote a lot on St. Helena and dictated. So yeah, it's a very touching part of his life. And also it's the great tragedy, because the man who just a few years before governed Europe now cannot even see his son. Can you imagine? He's not even allowed to send books to his son. I mean, it's the ultimate downfall. I mean, he loses everything. Part of why the story is so amazing. I mean, the man has nothing, gets everything, and then has nothing again.
Yeah. Yeah. Gangster movie. Yeah. Basically. And on that note, you know, perhaps a final one for me, obviously. You mentioned how he has so many characters in him, and you are fascinated by him as a reader, and someone is fascinated by him as a military strategist, genius, somebody is an emperor. According to you, and maybe you kind of answered this a little bit already, but what do you think is his greatest legacy? Just your personal opinion.
It's a great question. I think the civil code. I think the civil code is unmatched. Before him, France is governed by dozens of different legal traditions and local civil regulations. He takes away everything and he says, one country, one regulation. It's not a list of laws, the code. It's a conception of society. He organizes French society. And it's so powerful and so efficient that today, in 2023, half of the laws on the books are still Napoleonic laws. And of course, the impact is not only in France. It's on all of Europe and even South American countries. I mean, there's been theses written about the impact of the Napoleonic Code on South American countries. They copied many of the articles. I mean, it's really just a momentous achievement, and it's what differentiates him from all the other great military leaders who never touched this kind of stuff. But also, listen, the Egyptian expedition, he unlocked Egypt intellectually for the world. Without him, we may never have had the hieroglyphs. And, you know, if we don't have the hieroglyphs, we don't have ancient Egypt. And if we don't have ancient Egypt, I mean, we have this massive black hole in human history. So again, and his innovations militarily, the corps system copied by every modern army in the world after him. And just the impact on France itself when it comes to, for example, the great libraries he created, to go back to my subject a little bit. He's the first French monarch to have his portraits done in front of libraries. I invite you to look at the official picture of President Macron today in front of a library or with books on the desk. His impact is everywhere. He created modern France, and he influenced so many other countries. So this is what's crazy about him. It's not just the military, and it's not just politics, and it's not just the books, and it's not just the culture. It's everything. I mean, this man, and he died young. Yeah. He died at 60, you know, like it's insane. It's absolutely in his late 50s. So it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. Thank you for being with us here for more than an hour. I hope, of course, we as well, as Ridley Scott didn't manage to capture the whole aura of Napoleon in this time frame. But I hope we managed to give a unique perspective and leave a lasting impact maybe on our listeners.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I guarantee you, even if this is a not so good a conversation, we did a better job than Scott. but yeah. I encourage your listeners to read about him, because you know, it's so dangerous to think that this is a boring subject. It's absolutely not. I mean, this is the most, especially for young people, like, as you guys know, like, this is not something that's meant for 80-year-old history professors. He did most of this stuff when he was young. I mean, his life is to show you what's possible. and it's crazy and it's energetic and exciting. And I mean, just pick up a book, read more about him. You will not be disappointed.
Yeah. And they can read about it in Napoleon's Library by Louis Sarkozy as well.
Thank you for the plug. I didn't want to say it myself.
Somebody had to.
Thank you so much. Yeah, the book is available for pre-order on Pen and Sword's website. It's out in May, and it will be on Amazon in the coming weeks. But if you just type in, you know, Louis Sarkozy, Napoleon's Library on Google, you'll find it.
Yeah, it is probably more accessible than Napoleon's letters. But
well, I talk about a lot of the letters, so I hope so too. Yeah, but if you want to buy all the letters the Fondation Napoleon published in 2012, I think, or 2014, all of the letters together, a huge academic work. So all of the volumes, I think 12 or 13 volumes, I have them all here, and they're absolutely amazing.
Wow. Wow. But before we wrap up, we also have one tradition here where, and this will be familiar to you because we translate a quote from Montenegrin language to English for our listeners, and Luka has picked a quote for this episode.
As we are on the subject of...
Let's see how you listen to your father-in-law.
Oh, God, or my wife. This will get me in trouble. Oh, God.
As we were talking, obviously, about letters, Napoleon also mentioned our country, Montenegro. So it's kind of a fact, and I found the excerpt from his writings. And in our language, it says, Bonaparte se u toku svoje vladavine interesovao i za Crnu Goru, pa je tako 9. februara 1808. godine pisao svom maršalu, guverneru ilirijskih provincija, Ogistu Mormonu. Kako to da vi nikada ne pišete o Crnogorcima? Ne treba biti krut, treba među njih ubaciti agente radi pridobijanja prvaka te zemlje. And on English, it would say, during his reign, Bonaparte was interested in Montenegro. So on February 9th, 1808, he wrote to his marshal, governor of Illyrian provinces, Auguste Mormon, how is it that you never write about Montenegrins? You should not be rigid. You should infiltrate agents to win the champion of that country. For us.
That sounds exactly like him. is not, but if I'm going to call my publisher now and try to get that squeezed in somewhere, that sounds exactly like him.
And I actually have another one as well, where sometime later he says, he was on January 28th, 1808, surprised by the news of heavy fighting with Montenegrin troops. He wrote to the French governor of Dalmatia, keep an agent with the Montenegrin bishop and try to win over that man. So he was trying to infiltrate us.
Yeah, it sounds like he was trying to win the Montenegrins over.
Yes.
That's why the empire fell. We didn't have the Montenegrins. If we had Montenegro, we'd still have an empire.
Say that louder.
Yes. Thank you guys so much for the invitation. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you for coming as well.
Of course, of course.
We stay genuine, uncensored and unscripted, and we always will, as we have to order our usual. Share us, subscribe us, and stay tuned until the next Wednesday.
Iguzo!